Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 317, recorded October 13th, 2017. Daniel Abraham, The Expanse. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Storyblocks. Uncage your creativity. Get high-quality stock images for a fraction of the cost with Storyblocks. Go to storyblocks.com/triangulation to try it free for 7 days. And by Blue Bottle Coffee. Get fresh, high-quality, delicious coffee delivered right to your door. Visit bluebottlecoffee.com/triangulation for your free trial of Blue Bottle Coffee. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. It's the Twitch show where we bring interesting people from around the Geekiverse and we ask them the questions that our audience want answered. I'm Father Robert Ballester, in for Leo Laporte, and we've got a bit of a special guest for you. Now, folks, if you are into sci-fi, if you're into fantasy, if you like words on a page or action on a screen, you're going to want to stay tabbed because my guest is a novelist, a comic book writer, a screenwriter, and a producer. He has published dozens of works. He has collaborated with the creators of some of the most beloved sci-fi and fantasy properties on the planet, including co-authoring a Star Wars novel, Honor Among Thieves, with Ty Frank, writing Hunter's Run with George R.R. Martin, adapting Martin's Game of Thrones into a graphic novel, and of course, along with Ty, creating the international hit on page and on screen, The Expanse. He has been honored with the International Horror Guild Award, the Locus Award for the Best Science Fiction Novel. He's a multiple-time nominee for the Hugo Award, and this year his universe won a Hugo, again, for The Expanse. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome to the show Mr. Daniel Abraham. Daniel, thank you very much for joining us on Triangulation.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Triangulation is a chance for our audience to look into the lives of the people that they find fascinating. They know your work, they've seen it, they've appreciated it, they've been very excited about this episode because they're hoping that they're going to get spoilers for season 3 and 4 and 5 and so on and so forth. We're not going to do that. We are all about you. We're all about the things that have led you to this point in your life. Are you ready to play along?
You lead and I will follow you, sir.
Fantastic. Now, let's start with some of the basics. Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I am presently living in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Ty's joke about me is that I'm like a medieval serf who is born, lives, and dies within 3 miles of the same place. That's kind of my lifestyle. Until we were working on the show, I spent like 3 months in New York one time and 6 weeks in Seattle, and otherwise I was just in New Mexico.
So what is it about New Mexico? It's the land of enchantment. It's held you there for so long.
It's home. I mean, this is I know all the stuff here. I know where the good coffee shops are. My parents are here. My family's here. My wife's family is here. My dogs are here. My stuff is here. There's really never been much temptation to go someplace else. It meets my needs.
I want to bring that back when we start talking about your process of writing, because it's fascinating how in many cases the inspiration for a writer's story, for the words that he puts on page, will come from his experiences, from the places that he lives. We're going to ask you about how that comes from New Mexico, but let me start first with asking you how you came to writing. What was the first inclination you had that you wanted to be an author?
Well, I started writing more than my peer group around fifth grade. We had little practice writing things, a little journal that we kept in fifth grade, and I would gravitated toward writing ghost stories and reading them to the class, and you know, trying to find the grossest thing I could do, which was great fun. And then in middle school was kind of an interesting break for me because that was the point at which we had a short story assignment in one of my English classes, and I had some friends who I hung out with at lunch who thought that was really stupid and made fun of it. And so I had to choose between having friends and writing, and I ditched them. So then I made no friends later. But it's been part of the mix, you know, since forever. I didn't wind up publishing anything until kind of the mid 90s. And then in 1998, I went to a workshop called Clarion West, which was sort of the beginning of my professional career, where I actually started producing work and getting it into professional venues.
Right. But I believe your first published work was Mixing Rebecca. Was that back in 1996?
That's correct.
What was that about? And what publication did that go into?
That went into the Silver Web, which was a semi-pro surrealist magazine at the time. And understand, this was the first one where anyone had said yes. I'd been sending things out forever before that. And getting rejection slips and more rejection slips and other rejection slips and depressed and then more rejection slips. But I had started getting some very nice rejection slips. And then if I recall correctly, the editor was Anne Kennedy. I know that for sure. And I had sent her some stories and she had turned them down, and she had a music issue. She wanted to do a specifically themed issue on music, and I came up with an idea that I thought would work, and I wrote it and I sent it to her, and it was almost good enough. So she asked for some changes, and I made those, and then it was good enough, and she took it. Now, Anne Kennedy has since married and become Anne Vandermeer, who is the co-editor with Jeff Vandermeer. Some of the best anthologies we have going on right now. She's done The Weird. She was the editor of Weird Tales for a while when it was doing some really interesting work. She's very much still a voice in the field and was absolutely the one who launched me.
Now, would you say that it was a different era back then? Because you speak of this process of rejection letter upon rejection letter and then nicer rejection letters and then finally being published. It's different now. I've interviewed a lot of authors, and we've had a lot of authors who are friends of the network who started writing maybe 10 years ago, and they went straight to Amazon or they went straight to the internet, and that was their venue. And then maybe traditional publication came later. Do you see the process different now than it was when you were getting your start?
I think it's a lot easier to become a publisher now. When you're talking about going straight to Amazon or putting it on the internet, what you're talking about isn't writing. What you're talking about is publishing. When I was, you know, and there have been fanzines and small run magazines and vanity press and all of these options forever, but it was hard and people didn't do it because it wasn't rewarding. Now it's much easier, and it's much easier to get work out there, not because you have won over an editor or won over some sort of gatekeeper, but because you essentially become a publisher. I'm not interested in being a publisher, so it's a lot of work and it's a lot of things that you need to know that I don't know and I'm not that interested in finding out about because I'm really busy doing other things. I don't at all regret that those early stories and early novels are not in the world. They were terrible. They were bad. I mean, everybody starts off bad. That's how it's supposed to go. And the temptation to put something out before it's the best before it's something that you would want to look back at in 20 years and go, by God, that was good work. It's a terrible and dangerous thing. And I'm also pleased that I grew up before the internet could document all of my failures in, you know, taste and getting dressed and or driving a car or behaving in public. I'm glad that all of that vanished and was not documented. And my early stories are very much along that line.
I love the fact that you've made that distinction between being an author and being a publisher. And you're right. Today, we're publishers. We push things out into the internet. We take our content and we push it out. And a publisher really needs to be the gatekeeper to keep quality up and make sure that the content meets certain specifications and will be good for the audience that I serve. But authors are horrible gatekeepers of their own content because they think all of their own content is perfect.
Well, all of our content is almost by definition the way we would have done it. And that perspective is hard to bring to your own work. It's hard to know what you're putting out into the world as opposed to what exists in your head. There's a kind of basic disjunct between the experience of writing and the experience of reading. So when I have written something, I've imagined it very deeply. I have a really clear mental image of everything that happens, everybody's tone of voice when they say things, and what the place looks like, and what it smells like, and all of that stuff. And some fraction of that winds up on the page. And if I've done my job well, that fraction carries on into all of the people who then read it, and they get their version of it that they've imagined. But it's hard for me to know what's on the page and what people are going to get from the page because I've already got a fully formed model in my head. And I think, oh, yeah, no, that's exactly, you know, I have this in my head. Here it is on the page. Clearly it has all been communicated gracefully and well, and everybody will know what I meant. And it's almost never true, at least in the first draft.
I have a Jesuit brother who had to bring in an editor for a couple of his publications. And he told me, he said, I needed someone to kill my baby. Because I can't do it. You know, when I write something, like you said, it's exactly the way I think it should be. No more and no less. I need someone to come in from the outside who is not invested in my project whatsoever, other than the fact that I've asked them to edit it, and rip out anything that doesn't make sense, to reorder chapters, to change characters. And he said that was the most difficult thing he's ever had to do, but the most rewarding.
It is. Working with a good editor is eye-opening and will make you amazingly better at your craft just by understanding what a thoughtful, intelligent, educated, sophisticated person is seeing in your work that you didn't know or you thought was there and wasn't. It's critical. It's a critical part of the process and one we leave out. The closest I've ever seen, it's also something that the self-pub market kind of militates against, which is putting it aside for a really long time. If you take something that you've written and put it in a box for a year, 2 years, something like that, and then come back to it, you are at that point a new set of eyes, or as close as you're ever going to be.
Right.
But I mean, if you're looking to publish quickly, you don't usually want to take that time either.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're looking to publish quickly, if you're more of a blogger where every thought goes out, that's
And I have a blog, you know, I have a Twitter feed. I have all of those things too. I have some experience exposing my ill-considered opinions in public.
and as long as they end up on your blog or on your Twitter feed and not in your finished work, that's a good thing, right? I mean, that makes the quality of your book that much better.
Well, it's a whole lot. You know, I think there's also an argument that I could consider more fully what I'm writing on Twitter before I send it out too. So I think generally speaking, we both in blogging and social media and in writing tend to undervalue the revision process and overvalue the idea of creation.
Right. Let's get into your craft, because we've got people in our chat room who really want to know how you developed your craft over the years. You gave us a little bit of a foreshadowing of what it was like. You had to choose between being with friends, popular kids, or working on your craft. You chose your craft. That's absolutely admirable. You've also mentioned how many rejection letters you've received over the years before you finally got comfortable with what you were writing and with the type of story you were creating. Was there a seminal moment? Was there a rejection letter that was just nice enough for you to realize, I have a future in this? Or was it a success that really pushed you into this idea that, yes, I can make a career out of this?
It was more a method of reframing despair than anything else. When you send your work out and you get rejection slips back, it's demoralizing.
Right.
That's just always the case. It still is. I still put out ideas or projects or things that fail, and it's always a bummer. But when I was first trying to break in with publishing, with the short stories, I started thinking of it as a game that I played with the post office. It was like ping pong, but postal ping pong, where I sent it out and they sent it back. And then I sent it out and then they sent it back. And then I sent it out and then they sent it back. And as long as I was returning the serve, I was doing my job and things were good. That was the game. And if I needed more stuff to send out, then I would write something, and that was like the ping pong ball, and I'd send it out. And then eventually they stopped sending it back, which was actually sort of off-putting, because I had spent enough years thinking of this as a different game than when it actually started succeeding. It was strange. You know, I had rejection letters that were devastating. Hmm. I remember one in particular that I'm still a little bitter about. And I had some that were very encouraging. I had, you know, Ann Kennedy and Jeff Vandermeer both were very kind to me early on and very encouraging of my work. And I appreciated that tremendously. But by the time I had gotten to that place, I'd been failing for the better part of a decade. Now, there were other people who I ran into who were mentors for me in the craft. I worked with Fred Saberhagen, who was here in Albuquerque when I was in high school, and I worked with Susie McGee Charnas. I was her TA at a class at UNM back when I was there, who were specifically and personally very encouraging to me, and that carried for quite a bit. That helped a lot to keep the despair from overwhelming me. But the plan was always that I would keep a day job until I could live off the interest, and that didn't work out, but that was the plan, and that this was going to be something that I did on the side because it's who I am, and then I would do something else to make money and eat and pay bills. I don't think I really planned to make a living at this until it had already been happening for a while.
And that's such an amazing story for my generation. My generation is the pivot generation. If you try something and it doesn't work, you pivot away, which is a nice way of saying you give up and you try something that immediately succeeds. This idea that you were doing this for the better part of a decade, and by your own admission, receiving at least one rejection letter that sounded like it was pretty harsh.
Yeah, it was a little rough.
That's something that I think a lot of people just can't see themselves doing, staying with it year after year, day after day, rejection letter after rejection letter. Was there ever a time before you finally could say you had succeeded where you thought, this is not going to work, I should probably move on?
No. Mm-hmm. It was working. I was keeping a thing in the mail. They were sending it back. It was working. That was the game.
That's amazing.
it was going just fine. There was never a time when I thought about not doing this, there was a great deal of time that I thought about what else, you know, what I was going to do with my day job and how I was going to make money and, you know, who I was going to date and whether I needed to get to the grocery store or do some laundry or any of that. And then this was what I did. But that was axiomatic. That's just a decision that I made. And then that was there. I don't know why I would quit. I enjoy writing. I enjoy telling the stories. I enjoy doing that. And then after that, the setting it out for people to publish or not is really, you know, or at least it became much more a logistical matter of, you know, getting enough postage stamps. And that's not hard.
We're speaking with Daniel Abraham. He is the a sci-fi and fantasy writer, author extraordinaire, the co-creator of the Expanse series of books, and of course the sci-fi TV series. Daniel, would you mind if we took just a short break? When I come back, I'd really like to start talking about some of the collaborations that you've done over the last few years. Is that possible?
I would be delighted. Right. I'll hang here.
We'll be back there just in a second. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. Now, we live, as you've heard, in a content generation. We all like to create things, be it our blog or our Twitter feed, a professional website, a way for people to see our work, see who we are. But what we need to make that even more professional is a source of material that makes it look good, that represents us, that gives people an idea of the ideas that we have for them. Which is why I'm so happy to have Storyblocks as a sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. Now, Storyblocks lets you tell your story with quality graphics from their stock. Now, whether you need images for your personal or business website, social media, or your next creative project, Storyblocks offers high-quality stock images for a fraction of the cost. Now, you can download all the stock your heart desires from their member library, including 400,000 stunning photos, vectors, textures, and icons. You can save on millions of additional marketplace images, and their marketplace offers digital assets a la carte, with prices as low as $3.99 for full usage rights, up to $49 for video. Now, artists can take home 100% of the sale price, and all content is royalty-free so that you can use it for commercial and personal projects alike. New images are added regularly, so there's always something fresh to download. Now, I've used Storyblocks in the past because sometimes I need just that little extra shot. I'm editing a timeline together. I'm putting together a short narrative, and I just don't have enough in my B-roll. I can always jump over to Storyblocks, find something that fits the image, the tale that I'm trying to tell, and it looks like it was crafted perfectly for my project. That's the magic of Storyblocks. That's why I use them, and that's why I think you'll use them too. Storyblocks is your one-stop shop for all your stock media needs at a great value. Their content has been used by some of the world's largest companies, including NBC, National Geographic, The Travel Channel, and Discovery Channel. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to go to storyblocks.com/triangulation to try it free for 7 days. That's storyblocks.com/triangulation to download anything from 400,000 images and unlock discounts on millions of more. And we thank Storyblocks for their support of Triangulation. I'm speaking with Daniel Abraham. He is the co-creator of the Expanse series of books. He has really captured the mind of a sci-fi generation, and we're here to speak with him about his collaboration. Daniel, you've worked with some of the biggest names in fantasy, including George R.R. Martin. And actually, I would now include you among the biggest names in sci-fi and fantasy at the moment. Can you tell me a little bit about some of these projects? Let's start with Wild Cards. Now, Wild Cards was part of a shared anthology universe. Can you explain how this works?
Well, this was a big thing in the 1980s when I was kind of coming up in this. There was an idea of making a world and then recruiting a bunch of people to write stories inside of it. I think the first really big one was Thieves' World, where it was a fantasy setting, and it was maybe a dozen really good writers coming together to share characters and setting and have the different stories that they wrote in that setting kind of build on each other. I was not involved in Wild Cards when it started. My involvement in Wild Cards in the 80s was that I read it, and that was lovely. Wild Cards was one of these that was built out of a superheroes role-playing game that was going on actually in Albuquerque without me. that George and Melinda Snodgrass and Victor Milan and Walter John Williams and just a bunch of folks locally were playing, and they put it together to become a shared world superhero world, like DC or like Marvel, but with George being the one sort of in charge of the whole thing. And then year after year, the stories went on and they got bigger and wider, and more characters came in and more characters fell out. And then I came into it pretty late. I came into it in a book called Deuces Down that was an anthology of stories starring people with really minor, useless powers.
Those are the best in some ways, because you can really develop those characters.
It was fun. It was actually a lot of fun to be able to come in and say, here's somebody who can do something trivial, and here's the story where that was important for them. And then there was a real reboot. There was a real kind of next generation feel that they came to with Inside Straight, where we wanted to make an on-ramp for people who hadn't read the last however many books and wanted to come in. And I was very involved in that that book and the three that followed it. Trying to make the world accessible to people who were coming in. But there's a lot of people involved in that. We actually just had a gathering of them last weekend here in New Mexico, and it's a wide variety of really amazing writers. And we've got George, and we've got Michael Cassett, who was one of the kind of minds behind Max Headroom. We had Chris Claremont did a one shot for it at one point. Melinda Snodgrass has been doing it forever. And then we're also getting in new people like David Anthony Durham and Marianne Mohanraj and Carrie Vaughn, Diana Rowland. As time goes by and more people come in, you get more and more of this kind of intellectual and creative addition to the process. It comes out with some really interesting stuff.
What is it like to be reading something as a younger person, to enjoy a universe that other people have created, and then suddenly you're part of that creation? I would imagine that that's something that people think that they're doing when they're writing fan fiction, but yours is at an entirely other level. You're actually publishing a work that becomes part of the mythos of this narrative. That sounds just so strange and wonderful.
There is a certain ego boost to it. There's a certain payoff, and there are times when it's like, well, I'm gonna play this off real cool. I'm just like, yes, I'm a writer, and I will give my opinion on how we should do this. And that's absolutely part of it. And it's really gratifying, and I like to think that I brought some things that make the project more interesting and better. And, if not, I got to do it anyway. So that's cool.
I can imagine the analog being something along the lines of someone in an Expanse chat room who has all these wonderful ideas, and everyone just sort of says, okay, sure, fine. And then they find out that person has been hired to become a senior writer. I think that's probably the closest analog I could use to explain what that must be like, to be brought into the universe and given the power. It really is power to shape characters.
Mm-hmm. No, it's awesome. It's tremendously fun. And it's a little nervous making too, because you don't want to be the one who broke it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, let's talk about some of your other collaborations, because that's not the only universe that you've been part of. You've actually been part of the Star Wars universe. In fact, you helped to co-author one of the beloved stories, Honor Among Thieves. How did that happen?
Well, it was speaking of what it's like to break a universe, we actually wrote the last book in the expanded universe. Ty and I we turned out the lights when we were done. No, what happened was the folks who were doing the Star Wars books were looking for another on-ramp, actually. It was another on-ramp project. Mm-hmm. It was trying to make the expanded universe stories accessible to people who had not been playing and hadn't been following the books the whole way through. And so there was this plan for a trilogy of books that would be the kind of the big three, Luke, Leia, and Han, in between New Hope and Empire, and that would be intentionally built to be very inviting for people to come in. It would be, wouldn't require a deep knowledge of the other expanded universe works. So that was the assignment. And then while we were writing, Disney came in and bought the whole property. Right. And so we were the last book in the old continuity. And the second book in the series, the Luke book, wound up being the Luke book or was it the Leia book? I may be getting those mixed up. Yeah, one of them, whichever one was next, was the first one in the new continuity, the new Disney-based continuity.
Yeah.
So
Disney did want to control that content a lot more than
That's legitimate. I can understand why they would make that decision. It was just kind of weird to be on the ground when it was happening.
Right. Right. In working in that project, you're working with Ty. Was that the first novel that you've penned your writing name, your nom de plume? Was that the first emergence? No. What was the first book that?
The first book that Ty and I wrote together was Leviathan Wakes, the first book of The Expanse.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
That was the first one we did, and that was where James S. A. Corey was created. And then after we had done several of those, we were kind of, after that had succeeded, the guys at the Star Wars books were thinking, well, that one seems to be doing well. Perhaps they would like to come and play here. And you know, that was our intro. That and the fact that we both knew Ann Grohl, who was at Random House, and that was related to Dell, and people know each other in this really small industry. And so apparently, we had enough people who thought we were fun to work with that our name got passed up the rung.
Let me ask about this. I've always been curious when you have a team that decides to create a fictional person or an individual writer who decides to create a name that becomes a household name, even though it's not their name. S.A. Corey. I mean, of course, you've gotten it from both of your names. Why did you create this author of the Expanse series?
Well, this is not actually the only pseudonym I work under. I also did some urban fantasy under MLN Hanover. And it really comes from trying to set people's expectations accurately. Writers become associated with a certain kind of book quite often. And the more you buck against that, the more you risk losing people. I mean, if you pick up a John Grisham book and it's a baseball novel,
right?
Even if it's a really great baseball novel, you're kind of disappointed. Daniel Abraham, at that point, had written epic fantasy and that was fairly well received. MLN Hanover was writing urban fantasy, which was fairly well received. And if you had picked up Leviathan Wakes with my name on it and thinking it was, expecting an epic fantasy or expecting an urban fantasy, you would have been very disappointed because it's not either of those things. So by creating a new name, we avoided that. We had something that was a fresh start and people would know what a James S. A. Corey book was. That was easy. The other thing was because this was a collaboration with Ty, and this was Ty's first novel. And there's this prejudice, there's this belief that when you have somebody who's kind of established working with a name, writing with somebody you haven't heard of before, the guy who you never haven't heard of before actually wrote the whole thing and they just slapped the other guy's name on it, which I was nowhere near Tom Clancy levels at the time to justify that. But we didn't want to have that misapprehension. So it made sense at the time to build a new character, to build another guy, and have it be Jimmy Corey on the cover instead of us.
I think in this case that strategy worked out perfectly, because now we do associate that name with both of you, and you know, you're equally responsible for the creation of this wonderful universe. Now, let me ask a little bit about that pen name a little bit. Is there a pen name, because you mentioned that you had several, is there a pen name, you don't have to mention it, that might be writing in a genre we wouldn't expect out of you that might surprise us in the future?
Well, there isn't yet, but there might be.
That's a good teaser.
No, I've thought about that, actually. There's a real question at this point about what to do with my other names. Because James S. A. Corey is really the project of mine that has done the absolute best. I mean, far and away. Daniel Abraham was a nice, solid mid-list writer. MLN Hanover can't get arrested at this point. So whether to do new projects and try to build on Daniel Abraham, or try to revive MLN Hanover, or just to start another project completely fresh, those are interesting questions, and those are things that really are driven by the market and really are driven by the advice of my agent, and seeing how best to navigate those waters. So I don't know how that's going to go moving forward. There are some projects I have that aren't in any of these genres. And there are things I'd very much like to do. I'd really like to do some noir and some crime fiction. And I have some ideas for that, you know, might justify having another name come in.
We've got Beatmaster in our chat room who is wondering if you feel differently when you're writing under the different names. I think another way to phrase that would be, do you ever hold back certain stylistic elements thinking they might identify me with this other pen name that I'm using? Or is it always you?
Well, it's always the project that I'm working on. And different books have different voices. When you're writing epic fantasy, there is an almost stilted, formal voice that you use in order to make it sound right. I mean, if you have an epic fantasy where you know, the ranger swings into the dark tavern and says, "Well, shit, howdy, what's going to happen here?" It sounds wrong.
It does.
You know, it doesn't. That's not right. And Ursula Le Guin talks about this. There's an essay she wrote that's I think from Elfland to Poughkeepsie or something very close to that, that talks about how you have different voices for these different genres. So it's not that I'm not writing as Daniel. It's that I'm writing an epic fantasy. And if I was writing a contemporary thing, then it would have a more contemporary voice. When I'm writing science fiction, it has a lot of that same contemporary voice, because science fiction, a lot of it grew out of our present. So all of that is in its history. You can kind of pull that in a way that you can't in fantasy.
Right.
So, I mean, every book and every project has a different voice. Everything is reaching for its own requirements. But it's always me doing it. I just have a lot of different tools.
So how does that creative process work? You're writing a fantasy 1 year, and then you move on to hard sci-fi the next year. Is there something that you have to do for your process to make that jump from fantasy world, modern world? How do you move between the different narratives that you've created in your mind?
I find it very easy to do, actually. I mean, it's not any different than reading this stuff. I mean, it's you don't have any problem picking up a Stephen King horror novel and then picking up a John Grisham lawyer novel. You don't then think, well, but where is the evil monster that's about to eat the lawyer? You just switch channels. It's very much like that for me. These are all different stories, and they all have their own different universes. And I think especially maybe starting my generation, but maybe the generation before, we have a lot of practice and a lot of education from television swapping between contexts very gracefully. It's something we've all been educated to do.
One last collaboration question. You've also worked with George R.R. Martin. Specifically, you adapted Game of Thrones into a graphic novel. That was a very different type of collaboration. You're taking someone's existing work and you're turning it into really a new medium, a new art form. Was that a different kind of work? Did you have to put yourself in a different mindset to be able to do that? Because it's not just creating a narrative framework, it's telling it in an entirely different way.
Well, and the thing that was really interesting about that one, it was the only project I've ever done, that kind of adaptation, where if you noticed that I was in there, if you heard my voice in it, it was because I'd failed. My job at that point was to be invisible. It was supposed to be the Tommy's art and George's story and no Daniel. And that's a very different process.
How
that's
do you
a very
do that?
Different
gig. How do you take something out of a creative?
Well, it's just a different project. It's just a different obstacle to play with. It's how do you mimic George? How do you take George's work and cut it and paste it and take lines that he uses and to the degree that it's possible, either use his actual lines in a new context or generate new lines that sound so much like George that no one will see where the seams are. That's fun. That's not something I've ever gotten to do anyplace else. And I understood after doing that a lot more about how George writes and about how he works. I got to be in that story very deeply and see what the structures were. And ask questions to George, of course, because, I mean, the other thing that was strange about that was I was writing it not knowing what the end of the story was. So I didn't know what I could cut. I didn't know what I could leave out. I didn't know which details were critical. And there were times when there was something I said, we only got 22 pages. We kind of need to can I lose this scene? And the answer was no. No, you cannot lose that scene.
Now, you mentioned that you didn't know where the story was going to end. As an aside, do you think George knows where the story is going to end?
I didn't know where the story was going to end then.
Ah, okay. Okay.
I know a great deal about where the story is going to end. And I work with Ty, who was in the room when George was there with Dan and Dave, telling them how the story was going to end. Oh, wow. So, yeah, no, we know all the secrets. Between me and Ty, all secrets are known. We just don't get to talk about them.
Yes, but you have just put yourself on the target list for all of fantasy geekdom. They will be hounding you now forevermore to find those secrets.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
There you go. Now, when we come back, would you mind if we switched over to The Expanse? We have to talk about this expansive universe.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. We'll be there just in a bit. Again, we are speaking with Daniel Abraham. He is the co-creator, co-author of The Expanse series. Of course, the books, as well as the hit sci-fi series that is currently entering its third season. We'll be back with him in just a moment. But first, let's go ahead and take a break to thank another sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. Now, I don't know about you, but I need coffee. It's just become a staple. And it's not just in the morning anymore. I need it to drive me throughout the day. It keeps me sharp. It keeps me alert. And most importantly, it's just something I like to do. A good cup of coffee is a bit of relaxation in the middle of the day. Unfortunately, we don't put the time into actually choosing a coffee, into savoring a coffee. Well, we're here to change that with Blue Bottle. Blue Bottle is a sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. Now, my first experience with Blue Bottle was a blend called Three Africas, and I have it in front of me, and it just smells wonderful. You know that coffee smell, the freshly roasted smell, where it just says so many things. There's so many floral notes. It brings you in, it energizes you, and that's before you even taste it. Well, Blue Bottle has an insane dedication to coffee. They take freshness very seriously. They work directly with farmers all over the world to source the most delicious and sustainable coffee that they can find. 85% of their coffee is bought organic certified, and most of their blends are certified organic. The beans are then roasted within 48 hours of your order and shipped right to your door. They arrive at your home at peak freshness. No sitting on a dusty shelf for weeks. No being a display in a sunny rack. It's direct from them to you. Now, Blue Bottle has something for everyone, from the lighter fruit-flavored profiles to the deep chocolatey espressos, which I love. They also offer their night light decaf for those people who do want that flavor of coffee in the evening but don't want them to keep them up at night. It is, without question, without doubt, the freshest, most delicious coffee I've ever tasted. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to get your coffee nirvana on. Sign up for a free trial of fresh, delicious Blue Bottle Coffee right now at bluebottlecoffee.com/triangulation. That's bluebottlecoffee.com/triangulation. Your free trial will then become a 12-ounce shipment of your selected subscription with bi-weekly delivery. You can change, pause, or cancel the subscription at any time. And you can sign up for the free trial and claim $10 towards your first order. What have you got to lose other than bad coffee? That's bluebottlecoffee.com/triangulation. And forever put away those no names and subpar bottles of brew. We thank Blue Bottle Coffee for their support of Triangulation. I'm speaking with Daniel Abraham. He is one of the minds behind the expansive universe that is The Expanse. And Daniel, we have to talk about it now because it has absolutely taken off in the last couple of years. Did you know that The Expanse was going to be this kind of a hit, this kind of a cultural phenomenon when you first started producing it?
Oh, absolutely not. No, you never know that this is going to hit. I knew that it was fun, and I knew that it was something that we enjoyed doing, and I knew it was something that I wanted to do. And I was pretty sure, worst case scenario, we could sell it for a few thousand bucks and buy some pizza. And that was the plan. The plan was we would write Leviathan Wakes. We would sell it for about as much as I had sold my first novels, which we would then split and, pay some bills, buy some groceries. That was it. That was the plan. We have overshot.
Yeah, just a little bit. Now, originally, Ty had designed the Expanse universe as a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, and then later as a tabletop game. You came to Ty and you said, no. You've done far too much research to stop there. This needs to be turned into something full-fledged. What was that conversation like?
That conversation was more like, hey, you already did all the hard part. Why don't we write this down? I was playing in one of the iterations of the tabletop game. There were several. There were several versions of that got played through, all in the same setting, different places in the universe. And I was playing on Ceres Station, working for Star Helix Security, and my character was Detective Miller. And every time I came up with a question, what does the quarter look like? How does the water supply work? How did the money work? Ty knew the answer. He had it all at his fingertips. He had spent so much time thinking about the universe that it was done. It was complete. And the story was awesome. And the games were fun. And I was thinking, really, you just write this down. It's a pretty good book. And so I said we should write this and split the money. And he had never written a book before. He'd written a short story too and done quite well with them, and thought it would be interesting and fun to try writing a novel. So and the original plan was that he would tell me what to write, because I'd written novels. I knew how to write novels. He would tell me what happened and I'd write it down, and that would be how we did it. And so he told me what the beginning looked like, and I wrote it and I handed it to him. He said, yeah, this is close, but can I? And so we threw out all of my stuff and he wrote the beginning and I edited it. And then I wrote the next thing and he edited that. And then that became the process, where each of us would write a chapter and the other guy would edit that chapter, and we'd swap off until at this point, we both internalized the other guy's process well enough that we don't have to do it quite so religiously anymore. But it was something where we learned that process as we were working together on that first book. And when we were done with the book, the idea was that we'd sell it. And of course, when you sell things, it's easier to sell things when it looks like there might be more later on if it goes well. So we hadn't really planned that, but it seemed like a good idea. So we, as part of just the process, we're putting the sales pitch together. We came up with some ideas for a couple other books that maybe might be able to follow the Leviathan. And we needed to then need to come up with a series name because that makes it sound like it's a series. And I didn't know what that was going to be. So we said, okay, well, that's a synonym for big.
And there you have it. That was
and then it happened.
I'm glad that you brought up that the vignette about how he always had the answers, because that's that research that came into play. In fact, if you switch Carsten to my screen here, there was this scene early in the episode, first episode of the screenplay, the adaptation of the books, where you're showing. Now this could be a throwaway scene to non-geeks, but geeks look at this. And this was the first indication I had of they're going to take this seriously. You know, they've actually gone through the process of understanding how the physics would work on a spinning body that's trying to generate artificial gravity via centripetal force or centrifugal force. And when I saw this, I said, okay, I'm going to like this. And I think it was the same thing for most of fandom. We've got Specs in our chat room who's saying there's a delicious realism, even though I know that all of this is fanciful. There's a delicious realism that keeps me close enough to how I know physics works that makes me buy into the story so much more. Is that all the result of this research?
A great deal of that is the result of Ty's research and of Ty's dedication to not phoning in the science. And it's been something that we've struggled with. We've had generations of science fiction on television and in movies that has educated us incorrectly. Right. So that even when we get it right now, it looks weird. And trying to get close, trying to get that plausibility, has been really hard. It's been really tricky, and it's made, I think, a show that has a different feel than anything else. Just because you are reminded over and over that it's not magic.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that hooked me. After the first series, I was completely hooked because there was no magic tech. I think the closest you get to magic tech is probably the Epstein drive and the juice that keeps me from turning into a puddle at high G's. Other than that, I mean, it's not, as you mentioned, it's not what I expect from sci-fi. There's no artificial gravity. There's no warp drive that instantly gets me from one place to the next. There's no transporters. There's no magical material that can survive being hit by a micrometeoroid at millions of kilometers an hour.
And there's no shields.
And there's no shields, exactly. And the weaponry they use on the series, it's, I can imagine it, rail guns, Gatling guns, and missiles. Okay, yeah, we've got those. But it makes it harder to make sci-fi when you're trying to be real, right? I mean, it would be so much easier if you could add one or two elements of traditional space sci-fi and say, yeah, we don't have to worry about taking a shuttle from the ship to the station because I just transport over.
It makes it different. But part of what defines the feeling about any project, show, book, story, whatever, is the choice of obstacles. If you have no obstacles at all, it's going to be a terrible story. That's just if the rules can be anything for every scene, then it's terrible. So by choosing the obstacles, by choosing a different set of obstacles than the usual, it does mean we have to think things through. It does mean sometimes we have to chew things out that we wouldn't have had to do if we'd done something more familiar. But it also means we get things that nobody else has gotten to do because we have other things to work around. Mark and Hawk, Mark Ferguson, Hawk Osby, who wrote the pilot and who really launched this whole thing, the guys who did Iron Man and Children of Men, were talking about light delay, because we have light delay in the show. If something's going on Jupiter and you're on Earth, you're 40 minutes behind the start. And they were talking about how cell phones have destroyed the thriller genre, because everybody can just call and tell people what's going on anytime they want to. It's hard to have that tension of withheld information. And light delay gives you some part of that back, because something's going on and you need to get information to them. And it is physically impossible for that information to arrive until maybe the whole thing's already been decided. So that's something narratively we get back.
Right. Let me go a bit more into the realism of the show, because there was this one scene, I was actually looking for it right now, in season two, Doors and Corners, where there no spoilers for the people who haven't watched it yet or are not up to date, but there's a battle. There are several battles, but in this particular battle, you're doing a zero-G battle, and we actually see projectiles coming through the ship. And for a moment there was this, why are they doing that? The conversation in the back of my head, as you see sort of the hot fragments just sort of staying where they are. And I said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. If you were in zero G, the particles would just hang there until you applied acceleration. That's one of those moments where it makes me wonder, was that something you always had in mind? Was that something that the special effects guys just threw together? Or do you consider those moments a crucial part of the story, where it really brings the audience into, I'm experiencing this for real?
It's an aesthetic that we've chosen for the show that the whole team is in on now. I mean, I don't know if that idea originated with Ty. I imagine it would, or if it came from the VFX guys who have really invested a lot of time and energy in thinking about and understanding this, or in our showrunner, Naren Shankar, who's, he's got a PhD in engineering, and all of this is scratching his itch too. But at this point, everybody who is playing this game with us, everybody who's involved in this project, has started looking for those moments, has started thinking about those moments, and has started trying to find ways to incorporate them into the show, because it's what makes us.
Right. Well, the way that you do it, it's because I've seen shows that have tried to incorporate passable physics effects in their storylines, but in the way that it's done in The Expanse, it never makes me feel as if, oh yeah, focus on this, we're about to do something wonderful. It could be something completely in passing, something in the background that was true to physics, and on my third or fourth viewing, I'll see it and say, I appreciate that. That thank you for doing that, because it keeps me in the story the way it wouldn't otherwise. Now, there's this story going around that on this set, when they do have zero G, you actually have special markers in the script so the actors know if they're under loading, if they're in zero G, if they should be falling this way or that way. How do you coordinate that?
We do mark that all in the script. If it's in a zero G environment, there is a marker on the scene saying zero G. We don't differentiate between thrust gravity and spin gravity, because they're kind of going to look the same.
Right.
But the actors have all had, we've had astronauts come in and train with the actors on how your body moves differently and how you rest differently in a zero G environment, and so they've all really thought about that and really gotten a chance to think about how their bodies are, and we want to give them all the tools we can in those scenes to give the performance that sells the moment. And it's a great group of people, and they've all been amazing at engaging with this kind of extra level of work that we're asking from them.
At this point, is it second nature to them? Have they done it so often that they understand what they should be doing, what their bodies would be doing in a zero-G environment? Do they no longer have to be coached?
I think the Rossi crew has pretty much internalized it at this point. I think they they've spent so much time doing this, I would be surprised if they needed more than just a refresher. But we have new people coming in all the time. We have new actors and new roles coming in, and we have to go through and bring them up to speed and land the same thing with the new folks. So far it has never been a problem. Everybody's been really good about it.
Oh, I love the fact that for the Expanse series, from the beginning, you know that there's going to be 9 novels. So you have your narrative set, but you've mixed in a lot of these novellas, these shorter stories, and some of them have been wonderful, from the churn to explaining how Epstein discovered his Epstein drive. What made you do it that way? Why not just do the 9 books, or why not just do a continuing series? Why is it the canonical 9 plus little vignettes of life around the system?
Well, I would love to say that this was more noble than it is, but what happened was somebody came to us and said, would you write a short story for us in the Expanse universe? And we thought, that could be fun. it'd pay us. That sounds great. There was the guy named John Joseph Adams. He's the editor of Lightspeed. Actually came to us and asked us to write something for a project he was doing. And the first one that we ever did was called The Butcher of Anderson Station.
Right.
And it was it turned out not to actually work for the thing that John was doing. So he didn't take it. He rejected us. But we did the story, and then Orbit at that time, our book publisher, was starting up a short story thing. So we, handed it over to them and they published it, and that was fine. And then they kind of got a taste for it. So the second contract that we did, the one for Cibola and Nemesis and Babylon, also had 5 novellas as part of the contract. So they saw a value in that, and we saw a value in that. And it's let us kind of explore the niches and corners of the universe and tell stories we wouldn't have been able to tell otherwise. Because the characters that we're following, weren't there, or it was outside the arc and action of the novels. And I feel like it's made the story deeper and richer and just a larger project. And I'm very happy with that.
We've got Robert Bigelow in our chat room who is saying he loves the backstory on Julie. And the little vignettes that you give, that you're right. It's something separate from the main narrative, but it fits so well into the Expanse universe that they've made their way onto screen. I mean, the Butcher of Anderson Station was actually part of season 2. And can you go a little inside baseball here and tell me what's the process of deciding what's going to end up in each season? Because you're not doing what we would expect out of a movie studio, which is one movie, one book, or one book, one season. You are taking a little bit from this and a little bit from that. You're combining characters, you're combining stories, you're combining the novellas to give us a more compact and yet what still feels expansive narrative. What's the decision process for deciding what actually goes into the show from all the books?
Ultimately, And in its purest form, Narain tells us. That's the answer ultimately is he's the showrunner. We are there at his pleasure, and he is dedicated. It was always his idea not to adapt the books, but to adapt the story.
Oh, that's wonderful.
He was the one who came in and said, that's not one season, one book. The books are too big. The seasons are too short. We need to give this room to breathe. And we need to grab whatever works from wherever it is in order to, get the whole thing as rich and as full and in the right shape for this different medium. And Ty and I went into this very clear that we knew nothing about television. We came there to be useful, and we came there to learn. And I like to think we've been useful, and I'm certain that we've learned.
I actually want to spend some time talking about that entree into television, because it's, as you mentioned, it's been a learning process, and you've had a couple of critics who wrongly or rightly sometimes accuse you of doing this and that. And I've actually witnessed those Twitter battles, which are sometimes incredibly amusing because it's not me, but I'm sure it must be frustrating sometimes. Would you mind if we jump into that in just
a
bit?
For it.
All right.
Sure.
I'm speaking with Daniel Abraham. He is one of the co-creators of The Expanse Universe. If you've read the books, if you've seen the series on sci-fi, you know that it's quite possibly the best sci-fi we've had in a generation. We'll get back to that in just a bit. But first, we want to take a moment to thank another sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. Now, let me ask you a question. Did you enjoy the last time you had to go apply for a mortgage? I mean, bringing all those boxes to the bank, talking to a banker who was pretty much disinterested in your life, who just wanted to see your pay stubs and your receipts to see if you might be a good consideration for a loan. Well, of course you didn't, because it's a horrible experience. Unfortunately, folks, the mortgage experience has not caught up with the digital world in which we live. We expect something fast. We expect something convenient. We expect something like Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, they understood that the mortgage process had not kept up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. No more banker's boxes filled with old crinkled receipts. Just click and you're good to go. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. That means no more cookie-cutter mortgages, no more trying to force you into an existing mortgage. Rocket Mortgage will look at all the options and make sure that you get the one that fits what you're trying to do with your life. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Triangulation. We're speaking with Daniel Abraham. He is one of the creators of The Expanse Universe. And we're getting inside baseball. You mentioned this learning curve of going from writers, of creators of this expansive universe into TV and hitting the learning curve. What would you say would be the most challenging thing about moving from the page to the screen?
Well, the hardest thing for me was understanding what a screenplay is as opposed to a novel. I'm used to writing novels and short stories where who I'm writing for is very clear. I'm writing for the reader. I'm writing for somebody who's going to pick it up and they're going to read the words and they're going to imagine it. And that's going to be the whole transaction. And they're the final audience. Understanding who reads a screenplay and what it needs to do is something I've gotten way better at, but it's in a set of instructions to actors and to the prop guys and to the set designer and the set builders and to the VFX department and to the stunt folks and it's almost a sales document for the network and the studio so that they can see what it is and understand what the story is at the same time that it's a blueprint and a bunch of different blueprints. And it's not at all something for the final audience. It's not something that the audience is ever going to see. It's a construction document. And as such, all of the things that I'm used to doing to make things evocative and rich and kind of leave room for the reader's imagination to fill in is a really bad idea because they need to not fill in. They need to know what they're supposed to do. And that's been tricky. That's been hard. I think I'm getting there. Fortunately, Ty has been on set and in all the production meetings for all of the season one, a great deal of season two, all of season three. And so when I do a draft and I can hand it to him, he can fix what I've done wrong because he understands that part very deeply, and I can learn by seeing what he's changed. So that's kind of how we go about that.
It's fascinating when you speak of not being able to do the things that you can do on the page. You're right. I mean, as a writer, you can control what your reader is thinking or what he or she is experiencing, because you have the narrative. You are all of the voice coming out of that universe. But when you hand it over to a production team, you have to trust that your director and your actors will be able to convey that, will be able to portray that. That's a lot of trust.
And what comes out won't be what I thought. I mean, the other thing I need to do is be able to say, you know, I don't understand at all how to act for a camera. So if Steven decides that it needs to be done this way, he's doing it for a reason, and I should let go. I should make sure he knows the effect that I want, and I should make sure he knows what the story is that we're telling in that scene. And then once I've done that, I should tease and go away.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because one of the other things that I have just really loved about The Expanse, and I explain this to everyone who has not yet watched it or read it, is the fact that your cast, I don't know who was in control of your casting, but it is perfect. There were a couple of names when I saw them, I'm like, oh, really? That person? But the way that they portrayed the characters on screen basically fit exactly the characters that I saw on the pages of the book. Steven and Dominique and Wes and Kaz, they've all done great jobs with that primary cast. In fact, Christian Avasarala, I think, is one of the best characters in that story. I keep having these moments where I realize that's the character. That's not an actor playing the character. That's the character. Did you ever have one of those moments when you were watching the dailies thinking, yeah, that's what I wanted. Just do more of that.
Yeah, no, we have been incredibly lucky. And we've also had people who were coming in for roles that we thought were very small, and then we saw them act, and we thought, oh, no, that's a large part now. We're going to rejigger things because, ooh.
How does that work? So when you get an actor, and I think of a couple that you probably rejiggered, and they were great, by the way. They were fantastic, right? And they were sad. I was very sad when they died. But when you rejigger parts, do you do that on set? Do you talk to the actors? Because I suppose they already have all the scripts, and then you're changing things as you're shooting.
Well, the process of changing scripts keep changing until the day of filming and in editing and in post. And the final story is shifting until the last possible moment, depending on how much we have, how much latitude we have in that part of the process. So you can't change the lines in editing, but you can change where they are said and where you're looking. You can do additional dialogue. So all of that is actually way more flexible than it seems. And with the actors, you know, a lot of that depends on, how much time we have in development and between seasons too. I mean, Sadavir Ehrenreich became a much larger part after season one because, we had Sean, and he was awesome. And so we knew that we could put more of the story onto him and get great performances back. So we should totally do that. And Kara G is drummer. We brought her in, and she was able to, you know, she blew everybody away. And so we looked at each other and said, oh yeah, well, no, that's there's a resource. We should use that.
I go back and forth between drummer and Bobby as my second favorite female character. Christian is my favorite, of course. But you've got all these strong women in this universe. And it was interesting that became a mini controversy on Twitter for a while of, oh, they're just trying to play up to blah, 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 blah sensibilities. But for me, it was just, yeah, this makes sense. This is a complete universe. Of course, you're going to have strong women. Of course, you're going to have women who are very good at their jobs. And you're going to have women that you become attached to. That's one of the things that I've loved about The Expanse.
Well, and we're not playing up to anybody's sensibilities but our own. Right. The fact of the matter is, both of us are married to very strong, independent women, and we like them, or we wouldn't have married them. And so having people who we like be the kind of people who we like in the story too, that just comes with the territory. Choosing to have a future where it's not all Caucasian all the time, and that there are, you know, Kurds, and there are folks from India, that reflects the experience we have of our world and the experience we have of what's best about our world. And we try not to comment on it. We're not here to champion anything exactly. We're here to depict the world that we imagined. And this is what it looks like.
Well, one of the other things about how it looks is I love the fact that there are no major characters who are bad guys. You don't have the stereotypical bad guy. There's no person who is evil for evil's sake. Even the characters you hate and you want to see them die and just be destroyed, you can, if you're honest, you can understand why they're doing what they're doing. It's the same thing for George's Game of Thrones. Even the characters that you hate, if you look through their eyes, you can kind of understand why they're doing what they're doing. That makes for such a more compelling story than I have to be the good guy and you have to be the bad guy. Yeah.
Have you watched any Miyazaki films?
Yes.
So Miyazaki has this like 4-page comic book that he put out that's talking about the problem of good and evil and the idea of narratives where good is absolute and evil is absolute, and the moral problem of the universe is solved through violence, where good kills evil. That's one kind of set of stories. And then there's another set of stories where good and evil are interdependent, and you can't defeat evil. That's not something that can be done. You can find a place to be in balance with it, where the violence is not a solution to things. Even necessary violence is a necessary evil. And that's a much more interesting place for me. And I think it's a much more interesting place for Ty, because we keep going back there. And there are people who say that our villains are cartoonish. There are, especially in the books, people say that characters like Ashford and Murtry are mustache twirlingly evil. And yet when I look in the world, they're more rational and
right,
calmer and kinder and more compassionate than people who I see in the news. So,
well, I mean, even those characters, they have reasons for what they're doing. They're not just doing it because I'm an evil person and this is what evil would do. It's a much more compelling story.
They're doing it because evil is banal and concerned with completing the contract and having everybody think that you're high status and not losing face.
Right.
That's where evil lies.
Daniel, we have to do a little bit of fan service here. I want to start with something that I saw this Twitter battle. I actually inserted myself into it. You've had a couple of fans who were very upset about which content farms had the expanse and which didn't, which got season one and season two, et cetera, et cetera. Can we lay that to rest right now? The people on the internet who say, Daniel Abraham is keeping me from getting the expanse season two in X country. Do you have anything to do with that?
Oh, good Lord, no. No, I gave up all of my rights to The Expanse except the books when we signed the initial deal. Everything that I have done since then has been at the courtesy and kindness of Alcon Entertainment and Narain Shankar. And this is what happens. You write a book and you sell the rights, and then you don't have the rights anymore. I can lobby. I can tell people what I think, but especially when it comes to like business affairs and people who are writing contracts, I am not in that room.
Right.
It's frustrating. I mean, it is a legitimately frustrating issue. International distribution is complicated, and the business of working out the balance between the streaming and downloadable stuff from like Amazon and putting it on air on Sci-Fi, it's complicated, and there are a bunch of people in there with competing interests and competing ideas and competing models, and you know what comes out of it is not what I would have picked if it were me, but that's true for pretty much every part of this process.
Right. And I will put in my plug here. I buy the seasons on Amazon. However, I always DVR and then watch the episodes as they come on Sci-Fi, because it's my understanding that the studio loves it when I buy it off of Amazon, but it's not going to count for renewing the following season if I never watch it on the Sci-Fi channel.
Sci-Fi is very interested in having you watch it on Sci-Fi, and Alcon is less interested in any of it. As long as you watch it, they're pretty happy. So yeah, that's one of those competing issues. We would love to have people watch it on Sci-Fi. We would also love people to buy it from Amazon.
It's not really a problem for me though. I have literally watched season one and season two probably about 14 or 15 times each. Because I have a lab where I'm tinkering, I'm doing all my maker stuff, and I have The Expanse just running on loop. I love the story so much. I love hearing the sounds. I love hearing the dialogue. It's, of course, that panders to my OCD side. Let's do some more fan service here. We do have a couple of questions before we close up, because I know we're running out of time. First of all, we have a question from the chat room wanting to know if you are really going to stop at 9 novels, and why 9 novels? Why did you decide on 9 novels instead of just saying we'll go until we're out of story?
I think the best stories end, and I think that knowing what your ending is gonna be is really important in building the stuff that leads to it. I don't think that you can get to a place where you go, oh, and that's it, and now we're gonna stop, if you didn't kind of know you were headed there. And it wasn't always 9. We had a version of this that was built for 12 too. But as we looked at it and as we were writing them and as we went further in, it became clear to us that the 12 book version of this was actually, fatty and flabby and too long. And so this is the short version. We went for the short version. Now, that's not to say there won't be other James S. A. Corey books or other James S. A. Corey science fiction after the end of The Expanse, but the story that began in Leviathan Wakes ends at book 9.
Right.
And because we know what it is, we've known the last line, we've known the last scene, we know what the end of book 9 looks like since about when we were writing Caliban's War.
Wow. That's a great way to do it, working backwards. I nothing but admiration for that. We have a Twitter question from Albert Epstein, who wants to know if we will get the Churn or Gods of Risk on screen at some point.
That would be telling.
Okay.
people really like those stories, and we have a lot of options for how to approach them.
All right. And also from Epstein, how many seasons do you see 9 books becoming?
I think, you know, ideally I would like to do a version of this that we could wrap up in 6. I think we could do the whole story that we want to do in probably around 6. Seasons, and I think that's a pretty good length for what television is right. doing as an arc these days. So that would mean, what do I know? I'm not the showrunner. I'm not even I'm not the studio, but I think there is a path through this that gets us there in 6.
That's also a great number of seasons for syndication. So we'll leave it at
that.
Do
we still do syndication? Is syndication still a thing, or is this streaming world now? I don't know how this works anymore.
Yeah, and we'll leave that up to the studio. We've got a question from Zia on Twitter, who wants to know what elements of A. Bester and K.S. Robinson most influenced your work on the Expanse novels?
I would guess probably Bester's use of belters. We absolutely have our DNA coming straight from Alfred Bester. We absolutely admire Kim Stanley Robinson and the Mars books and Antarctica, and those guys are bedrock. Nobody has done a more beautiful and well conceived version of Mars than was in the Mars trilogy. I don't think anybody has crammed as many amazing ideas into a short book as Bester did in Stars My Destination. We absolutely owe those guys tremendous debt all the way through.
Indeed. One more question from Pirate, speaking of Mars, wants to know if could a belter live on Mars without any sort of assistance? Of course, we know a belter can't really live on Earth because they've been in low gravity their entire life. But is the gravity on Mars low enough where they could live comfortably?
Well, it's going to depend on the belter. Somebody who gestated and developed entirely on the float, even a third of a G would probably be a problem. And of course, we're making all this up. But somebody who had spent a lot of time on something that was under thrust would probably have a better time, would certainly have a better time on Mars.
Right.
This is one of the big changes between the series and the book, of course. In the books, we spend a whole lot less time under thrust than we do in the show. In the show, we're almost always under thrust, right. Because that way we can have people walk, which is nice.
Right.
In the books, most of the time most of the time on journeys is spent on the float. And for that, you spend a large part of your time in genuinely zero G. That does terrible things to your body.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of those guys from the books, it would actually be pretty hard even at the third.
I mean, we know that from just the science we've done. We know that people who spend extended stays on the International Space Station, after a year, they'll come back and they will be weak for months. And some of those effects they never recover from.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, space is a terrible place.
Well, especially if you've got Gatling guns blowing you out of the skies. One last question before we bid you farewell from SQE Jedi. Wants to know about the Expanse VR experience. If you're interested, or if Ty is interested in writing for it at all, is this something that you would consider expanding the Expanse universe into?
I would love to see a fully realized VR game of the Expanse. I think that would be amazing. I think we're well suited to it. I think that VR technology is coming close to a level where it's possible. If that happened and they wanted us to come play, I would absolutely expect us to do it.
We have been speaking with Daniel Abraham. He is the co-creator, co-author of the Expanse series of books, which has been turned into a hit series on the Sci-Fi Channel. He is the author of dozens of published works and has collaborated with some of the biggest minds in sci-fi and fantasy. Daniel, if I may call you Bharatna, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for sharing a little bit of the inside baseball of production of the creative process. This has been an absolute joy for me and for our TWiT audience.
Well, and thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. If you would, could you please tell the folks at home where they might be able to find you? Where's the best way to see what you're up to, see what you're doing, and maybe even converse with you on Twitter in a way that's not threatening at all.
Well, we'll see what happens with that. for the official announcements, you can go to www.jamesessaycorey.com or my blog, www.danielabraham.com. Both of those are available. For Twitter, there are two places you can find us on Twitter. There's at James S. A. Corey, which is our official shared Twitter handle, though Ty often runs it. And then mine is at Abraham Hanover for the other two pseudonyms. And also, if you get a chance to read the work by Dr. Julia Shaw there. She did an amazing piece of work in her most recent book. She's really done some interesting stuff.
Absolutely. Daniel, thank you so very much. And folks, if you have a chance, absolutely buy the books. Buy the series of books. Buy the series on Amazon. Watch it on the Sci-Fi Channel. We love sci-fi. We love hard sci-fi, especially well-researched hard sci-fi. And I have to tell you, as a lover of sci-fi for more than four decades, The Expanse rates right up there with all of my favorites. Daniel, once again, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, too.
And happy to be here. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Twitloda, for this last hour and a half of Triangulation. Now, don't forget that we do this show every Friday now, and normally at 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. Of course, you want to check the schedule at twit.tv/cal or cal.twit.tv. Also, don't forget that you can find our show page at twit.tv/triangulation. If you go there, you'll find all of our episodes, all of our guests, as well as a subscribe menu. This is important. If you want to keep us going, if you want to see fascinating guests on Twit TV, make sure you get the audio version, the video version, or the high-definition video version into your device of choice each and every single week. Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballasaire saying goodbye from Triangulation.